If you listen to our last episode, this is Comic Playground. I should probably tell people that, along with Fireside Crew from Fireside Chats.
Ooh, you got it.
Yeah.
Well done.
I'm trying to work on that stuff.
It's like you talk for a living.
We had some... No, not in my own voice. We had some technical difficulties at Phoenix Fan Fusion of no fault of our own. I'm not doing that to have an excuse from us, but our tech side does a fantastic job. And... So we are setting up some stuff. The answers from our incredibly wonderful panelists, Billy Tucci, Richard and Wint. I gotta do that better. Ready? Hey, welcome back to Phoenix Playground. Hey, welcome back to Comic Playground. We have our guests along with us from Fireside, the Welcome to Fireside Chats programming crew.
Programming crew.
Whatever. Who cares?
Just using words.
Mr. Maurer and Mr. Menti. I can't even think your first name at this point. It's been a
it's
long.
It's John. It's not a hard first name.
Yeah, but I call you jerk off so frequently.
Oh,
I think.
Geez, come on now. I don't know if we can say that. So we're a lot nicer than you guys. Adonis Blake is here with us, along with Donnie Ivory.
Yep.
And some of our questions got cut off. Like I said, the microphones had some issues. So this is the way we started out. The first question asked to Billy Tucci from Mr. Maurer and for the Fireside Crew and the Fireside Chats podcast.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk to Billy about his journey from starting his own production company all the way through his successful Kickstarter campaigns. And he got to talk about why he got into the business and, you know, keeping that business mentality about it, as well as talking about, you know, the fan mentality.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm like with the Peenies, what they did, a huge influence on me. And I started out because I couldn't get work from Marvel and DC. Nobody would hire me.
Mm-hmm. So neither could we.
You know, so I said, well, the hell with you guys.
I didn't get any either.
Yeah.
We're talking about work here.
Okay. Crashed by Augustine! Augustine 1, Caliendo 0.
Just one?
I apologize. So then I said, you know, the hell with you guys. I'll make my own book. I had no idea what I was doing, but I researched it. I had no idea how to make a comic book, but I went to the library about self-publishing, and then I talked to retailers, and I found out about Diamond and all that. Anyway, so I kind of caught lightning in a bottle with our book, and it really took off. And I self-published for 10 years, did over 100 issues, just about 100 issues of She, and I started publishing a lot of other books and stuff, and I just got burnt out, you know, and then I kind of just went to, well, you know, I made friends with everybody from Marvel and DC. Now they want me to work for them, so I did that for another, you know, 15 years or so, and now this is our 25th anniversary, and now I'm going back with this crowdfunding phenom that's happened, that anyone in this room could be the next Robert Kirkman of Walking Dead. And you guys can publish your own comics through crowdfunding, through Kickstarter, through Indiegogo. And it's amazing because it's actually a format where you actually, the creator goes directly to the consumer. You skip the retail, and I'm all for retailers and the distributors, the comic book distributors, but you cut them out. And it's just you to them, and it's an incredible testament of faith in the consumers and the readers and the fans that they'll take money out of their own pocket to give to you because they have that faith in your creation. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing of how much crowdfunded comics have raised in the past even 2 years. They're like a huge sliver of the pie of how much money comics have made, comic books have made in the past 2 years or so. And I think it's like 10 or 12% of sales. And I think Marvel has 40 or 50, and DC has 40, and then the rest is cut up in the smaller, not 40, but, you know, 20, 25.
Nowadays, even the big three, if you want to, their percentages are much smaller than you'd think.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It used to be 40, right. But they're down around 30, 31, DC and Marvel.
And then ours is growing, and it's great because you own this. It's your property. It's something that we own. And there's nothing better than having your book. And someone comes up to you, something you wrote, something you illustrated, or you just wrote or illustrated, but it's your creation, and asks you to sign it, and says thank you. And you're like, oh, no, thank you for getting this. And it's an amazing experience. It's never been easier. It's not easy to publish a comic because if you do a crowdfunded book, you're also a promoter. You're also the shipper. You're, you know what I mean? You're doing so much more than just sitting there in a little cloistered by your computer writing or at a drawing board and drawing, because you have to be out there engaging with the fans. But you know, you're passionate about that, your project, and your enthusiasm's contagious. And those people will bleed off of that. They will come to you. And it's amazing. We've built a great community, and I mean, millions of dollars are being made every year going directly in the pockets of the comic book creators themselves.
And those fans are actually your publisher.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you can take those books, and what's great for independent publishers is now that you can go up against the big two through comic book stores, through Diamond Comic Distributors, and you could say, okay, here's my book, it's done. And I have a guaranteed ship date of October 4th, and it will be in that store. And you can even say, because so many books are late now, I mean, yes. Books are rampantly late.
That's a thing.
Yeah, that's a thing.
It's always been a thing.
Yeah, it's always been a thing. But you can have that guarantee, and those retailers and those fans will know if they choose to go through the comic book shop. You do a different cover, so it's a different issue or something. But now we can compete on a more level playing ground with the big two or big three, because your books are already done. And you have to look at this, too. Is anybody out there want to make their own comic? Anybody? Well, the cool thing is, remember, it's a business. You got to think it's also, you know, it's our passion. We all got into this because we were fans, you know? But the thing what's cool is that you have to think of it with a business mentality, not just a fan mentality. And you could make a great, great living doing it, self-publishing your own work. You know what I mean? I mean, of what we've done, it's amazing. It really is.
You're talking about pioneers over here.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Right, yeah, so they are the, yep.
As we moved along in the panel, John Menti, I remember first names now, had his question that he asked.
So I wanted to ask a question to Richard and Wendy Panini.
Panini? No, just keep going with it. No, this is going to be in. You're not cutting this. The Paninis.
I wanted to know, because they had the opportunity to work with so many other publishers as well as have their own publishing company, what the influence on those of the major publishers like Marvel, DC, and Dark Horse, what that did to their own personal publishing company of Warped Comics.
I'm insanely jealous of you because you said you went to the library and there were books on how to self-publish.
No, there was books on publishing, just on publishing. Yeah,
we didn't have that.
Yeah, there was books
we didn't have in my day.
Why I remember.
We had exactly the same experience. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be a publisher. I had no knowledge of it. No desire for it. I can't speak for Wendy, but my picture was, she's got this beautiful artwork, we've got this great story, we're going to go to Marvel to DC, they're going to love it, they're going to write checks to us. Mm-hmm. That's the process, mm-hmm. Bottom line.
However, when we brought it to Marvel to DC way back in the mid-70s, they gave us an interesting adjective. They said it was too peculiar. Peculiar.
They didn't want to do it. A couple of other smaller publishers didn't want to do it. So Little Red Hen, we did it ourselves, and we did the first series for 7 or 8 years. And we love irony. Irony is the best feeling, almost the best feeling, in the universe. After we finished our initial series, Marvel came to us because, and just as you said, you caught lightning in a bottle, ElfQuest caught lightning in a bottle. Our first issue sold 10,000 copies at a time when fanzines were 200, 500 copies, and the second issue was 20,000, and by the time we were done, it was 100,000.
With those numbers, what would you translate that to today? Was it
about a million?
Oh, really? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, wow. Back in our day, we were outselling some of the, maybe mid-level X-Men and Batman titles from Marvel and DC. And that encouraged us tremendously. So when Marvel sniffed that, they said, can we have a reprint license? And that's when ElfQuest was reprinted by the Epic line.
Right.
And we were thrilled, not only for irony's sake, but we were thrilled to do that because that put ElfQuest onto newsstands, which was something that we could never have gotten by ourselves, because the direct market is the shops. And we got a whole new audience as a result.
That's what I was going to say, that much to our joy, that having ElfQuest on the newsstands as almost like a mainstream comic.
Oh, sure, yeah.
got us a whole new readership of, you know, people who maybe had been reading superheroes, but they were curious about this new thing.
And the whole point of it is, we're independent. We have never given up the right self-quest to anybody. We are fiercely independent, but independence does not equal isolation. So if you're Marvel or you're DC or you're Dark Horse and you come to us and say, we're interested in working with you and we can both come to a good place in a negotiation, they have resources we don't have, we have a property that they want, we're pleased as punch to work with other companies to get our story out there. Because that's the main thing. Get the story out there. Get readers. Yep. Put eyeballs on the page.
If you're a creator, you need somebody to receive it.
Oh,
the fans are more important than just about anything else. Mm-hmm. The buyers.
Any artist who says, I'm only doing this because I want to do it, is lying. There's not an artist who doesn't want somebody to look at what they do and provide feedback, hopefully positive feedback.
Well, speaking of positivity, how about that for a segue? Zach,
I don't understand.
Zach actually asked this to Brian Augustine, and Zach wasn't able to be here right now, so filling in for him, the talented and wonderful...
Oh, the best reader there is.
Donnie Ivory, yeah. You just see, can you remember what he said? Or just remember, don't read it off the thing, just remember what Zach... Or
no,
not. Okay, yeah.
So Zach to Brian.
Donnie, I'm just worried you didn't have to be here. That's what we waited around all this time. I wanted you to do something, and it wasn't going to be good. So Zach had asked Brian something to this effect. He had asked him, or he actually started with a statement. He said, you'd created a whole new universe with Gotham by Gaslight, which was the Elseworld, the first Elseworld. I guess I'm as bad as him, huh?
Yeah. Well, and he didn't even get to... complete his statement. Exactly.
Right, because Augustine took over, as he tended to do, which was great, because we really got to love him. But he did bring this up. He said, you created a whole new universe with Gotham by Gaslight, which was the first Elseworld. And the response that Brian Augustine gave was this.
Yes, it was, accidentally.
What's that?
It was accidentally the creation of Elseworlds. Okay. That term wasn't in my mind. We were just doing a one-shot. And then the minute... it did well, Denny O'Neill, the editor of Batman, was inundated with, you know, Batman in the Peloponnesian War and, you know, Cave Batman and all this stuff, a lot of which got published. They were all pitches by fairly major league talent.
Mm.
So we did get Batman in the Civil War and Batman versus Al Capone and all that kind of stuff. And Denny created the word Elseworlds to set apart that everything is, we should have called them, you know, Else Universes, because none of us connected. They were all standalone one shots. And, you know, for like the 8 years until saturation point, we were a cool different thing within the mainstream.
And as this answer was coming along, I tend to do this, interject quite a bit when it's not my turn, but I really was wondering, because of certain things I'd heard and talking to a good friend of mine, Todd McFarlane, about how Venom had been created, which the story behind that, and I played for you guys because we actually recorded Todd talking about this. He was telling Juliet, my daughter, about it. When he went to draw Spider-Man, the Spider-Man was in the black suit already, and Todd didn't want to draw Spider-Man in the black suit. He wanted to draw him in the blue and red suit, which was the historic colors that Spider-Man had always been. So he created a character, Venom, as a bad guy that looked like Spider-Man, was in black, and was stubborn and didn't want to do it, and Venom became this huge character out of Todd being stubborn, and he basically said, he blatantly says that himself. So I asked Brian Augustine how many times a mistake had been made that he had done, or in something that wasn't what he expected. How many times did that become something big? And this was his response.
Gotham by Gaslight started out as an annual filler. You know, the guy had to fill his annual, and he said, let's do alternative stories. Mark Waid, I don't know if anybody's heard of him, but he was editing before he became a big writer, And he said, let's do alternative stories. He was editing a book about the origins of all our characters. And he said, they give me an annual just after I finish doing Batman, Batman Villains, and Superman. Now what do I put in to an annual? Annuals are almost considered throwaway. It was something to sell. People, the customers expected it. And so we come in, and he takes Wade takes my pitch, because I gave it to him like overnight. He takes the pitch for the Victorian era Batman, which to me just seemed the perfect location, a Gothic era. Mm-hmm. And Dick Giordano, who beloved head of the company, beloved inker and artist, was our boss, and he said, this isn't an annual. This should be a one-shot. Mm. Mm-hmm. And if you can find an artist who's right for the story and who gives this a little more prestige, we'll publish it as a cardboard cover, one-shot, standalone.
And for the general audience, me including, can you tell me what the one-shot is? Because
a book that stands alone.
Just stands alone. So it's just only by itself. Nothing.
That's right.
Okay, gotcha. So it is what it says.
So we come out of Dick Giordano's office thinking, who's the right artist? And a guy named Mike Mignola, who you may have heard of again.
Oh, yeah.
The lady with the devil horns has certainly heard of Mike Mignola.
That's Maleficent.
I just meant she probably met some of those people. See? I can read an audience. I'm hoping we'll get to the good part soon. Anyway, we walked out of the office, and I swear to God, it was a hell of a line moment where the right person was just there. Mignola was walking past, and we said, Mike, can we talk to you? And he said, I can't do anything. I've got assignments. But we pitched the whole story to him, and by the end, he was adding things. Mm-hmm. Wait, what if we do this? And then he stopped, and he said, oh, bleep, I'm going to do this book, aren't I? Yeah.
Was that in your mind at some point? Like as you got into it, like this is something I'm gonna try and.
Not really. No.
No. I thought it was going to go. It was going to be the one shot.
It was huge.
I knew it was going to be a one shot, but I had no clue.
You didn't think it was going to.
It's a comic book. I mean, it was cardboard cover or not. It's a comic book.
Right.
It's a 48-page comic book.
Is that all? I have it. It was only 48 pages.
The story might even have just been 46. Wow. I don't actually recall.
Oh yeah! Wow.
And then we got an appeal for a follow up, so we did that, and then like I say, Elseworlds began like a flood from all these other creators.
Next up, Adonis had a question for Brian Augustine as well.
Yeah, and it was mainly going off of what we were talking about before, and my question was, how do you feel about the editing that has been done for the TV TV of your work, the animation, the movies, and things like that, and where they were going from a different medium? And this was their response.
How do I feel about the animated? Well, it was a 48-page story that they had to turn into a 90-minute film. So, you know, we have almost created it as a mantra, is to say over and over, it's an adaptation. It is a separate entity based on the work we did. There are things they did that I kind of loved and wished I had thought of. The inclusion of Selena Kyle, Suffragette, fit the era and fit the story, and it was tremendous. Their payoff, yeah, not so much, but it's an adaptation. So I felt fine about it. You know what the best part was? My name is on the screen.
That's cool.
And now I have an IMDb page, so it's kind of empty, but I have one.
At this point in the panel, distinguished member Corbin Ford asked our panelists and podcast guests how it felt from writing their own characters to writing for other people's characters.
Yeah, well, it was exciting because as a comic fan, you know, that I got to do like Sergeant Rock and to bring back, you know, these characters that haven't been around for a while. I loved it. I really did. It was a relief, but it was also a real passion project. But I think I did one book, Sergeant Rock, The Lost Battalion, and I lost so much money. because it took. So I would spend 3-4 days on a page because I was recreating the Normandy invasion, and I wanted everything right from all the uniforms and everything. And I remember my wife wasn't too happy about that one. She's like, you know, you got to start, you know, moving on it. But that was wonderful. It really is being a fan to write these characters. But then on the other end, they also break your heart. You know, because you can go with this character you love and you can have this passion project and you know it'll sell. And then you go to them, they love it, and then they'll make you like, okay, can you break that down to 6 issues? And you're breaking down an entire 6-issue series of 2 pages each, and you spend like 2-3 weeks on it. And then they come like, yeah, okay, that's great. Okay, well, let's work up the schedule and we'll do that. And then you don't hear from them. Mm-hmm. And then something happened. Something came in. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, we pushed that back. But, you know, we still want to do that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and you're like, I just spent a month. And, you know, and you just feel like, and a lot of our fellow creators say that. They're like, they'll break your heart because you'll have this really special, wonderful story that you know will do well as you know, sell as well. But because of somebody else is using that character maybe for one of their big event things or something like that, you can't use that character. Right. But we'll do it. But this is great. But once that's over, let's do that. Like, well, when do you pay me to write the script now? Oh, yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get you to paperwork. And then forget it. You don't hear from them for a year or so. So there's two sides of the coin because when you do get to do it, it is a lot of fun. And I've been very fortunate that I haven't had a lot of editorial interference because I like to do stuff, golden age things and stuff like that. So I don't really mess with the current continuity. I've been lucky like that. But so that's great and it's fun. But then on the other hand, there's also that part where, you know what I mean?
That's how Hollywood treats you too.
Yeah.
Anytime they option your property and, you know, they're looking to adapt it to a film or television. Yeah. Oh, well, we are the biggest fans in the world of this, but let's change it.
Yeah.
No, we just love this.
Change everything.
Let's change everything. And then you do a storyboard you do a treatment.
Yeah.
With the changes.
Yeah.
And then they don't like those changes. And they're like, what happened?
But it's their ideas and they do it on a whim. I mean, like they're like, well, how about we do this? Let's, because we're on our third film producer. And now we look like we have a good one for Wapsin Shi. Actually, they purchased it. Well, they actually purchased it. They exercised the rights and paid half the purchase price. So like, oh, well, maybe we're making a movie this time. Mm-hmm. But I've had producers like off the top of their head, like, oh, let's have a fight on the train. Would it be great on top of a train? I'm like, well, I'm paying for it, so let's do that. I'm like, okay. And then they're like, train. That's kind of weird.
Where'd you get that idea?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I had another producer that they like wanted to change. My character's like a modern day samurai story with my character, Shi. It's about a woman who is, she's a soldier drafted into a shadow war that's existed since the fall of the samurai. And now, but instead of them on battlefields in armor, the war is carried over to in business and the arts and entertainment. And it's just a shadow war that laces in and out. And I think it's interesting and cool, and everyone else seems to get it until I do it.
You should do a comic book.
And our last producer before this one said, yeah, you know, it's just a little too Japanese. and I'm like...
So Zach, responding to what Billy was talking about, when he said that we might be getting a new Shi movie, immediately jumped to trying to find out who does Billy want to play Shi, and he had some interesting answers to go along to that.
I want Shi. Well, my new story, if I may jump in, my new story, we're done? We're done. It's 25 years. My first comic, Shi, came out 25 years ago, and it's called The Way of the Warrior, the first story arc. My new one, which is coming out, we're launching it via Indiegogo and Kickstarter in July, is called Return of the Warrior. But the story will now have progressed 25 years. So now my character, Anna, is in her mid-40s. She's a single mother raising her teenage daughter, and her warrior days are far behind her, and it all comes back. You know, and I love the idea of a comic book character growing up. But for the film, we have a meeting in San Diego, is I want the daughter to be the star. I want it to be about the daughter whose mother was a part of this shadow society, but now she lives in New York, and you know she's left it. It all comes back to her, and she has no idea, the life her mother had, you know, before. But now, in order to save themselves, they have to She has to learn this sort of thing. So I don't know, some Disney kid or something. Someone, I don't know, you know. Give me some, you know. You know, like 16-year-old me, she's like
Demi Lovato.
That's right. It is too Japanese, so maybe get Demi Lovato.
There you go.
All right. So I had some more questions for my favorite sandwiches, Wendy and Richard. I wanted to know I recently found out that their entire back catalog of ElfQuest they were giving away for free online. And when Marvel picked them up, one of the things that Marvel wanted to do was to reprint all of that content. So there was a lot of value in that content in the first place. So I wanted to know, with things like the royalties and the fact that Marvel was willing to reprint everything, why give away that content for free? And this is what they had to say.
No, there was a Marvel and DC, I think it was Marvel first, and this was some years ago, they let's monetize digital comics. And nobody could find a model that worked, you know? Do we charge a nickel a page, 99 cents an issue? And it was chaos in the marketplace. And I thought, well, geez, we've got all these thousands of pages of stuff. I want to try to get on that bus. But watching all of the chaos that Marvel and DC and some other companies were trying to do, my reaction was, this is too crazy. It's too much work for too little real monetary reward. If we go back even further to the very first series that Warp Graphics published in 1978, our first issue, as I said, we sold 10,000 copies, and kids discovered it, and they discovered it at issue number 3, and issue number 1 was sold out. And I said, okay, I'm going to go the book publishing model. I'm going to reprint issue number 1, which really cheesed off all the retailers.
Oh, really?
Because they were selling the first printing of issue number 1 for inflated bucks. I didn't care about that. I wanted new readers. That's all I ever wanted. Well, not to go broke, but... So, to come up to the online thing, all right, I can make a nickel a book if I go through some crazy e-commerce site and go through all the hoops and tax numbers, or I can just say, look, ElfQuest has been good to us. We can afford to scan the pages, to put them up there, because some kid who has never heard of ElfQuest is going to go to ElfQuest.com and he's going to click the read it button and he's going to discover a whole new world. And that was the total rationale. I wanted new readers, period, end of report.
Great job. Did you call it a reprint when you did the reprint? Second printing?
Do what?
Did you, when you reprinted ElfQuest number 1, did you call it a second printing? Or
I didn't know enough. I didn't know it, man. We get this question all the time. Well, I've got it, and it's got this price on it, and this, that, and the other thing. The only way I am able to tell that it's a first versus a second or third printing is that when I went back to print the covers, the color shift was a little different on the second printing.
Wow.
And then the third was a little more red, and the fourth was a little more blue, and by issue 5 we were up to $1.25 instead of $1. And it's arcane as all get out.
Yeah.
But they're interested, so you know, we'll try to fill their informational need.
I broke in about 4 years after you guys, like I said privately. You guys are a model for a lot of people who are not ready or not mainstream, maybe peculiar. so long before, you know, 5, 6, 7 years later, I was hired and entered the mainstream big, but we started out self-publishing. And the story about reprints and all, that's exactly the story we had, even, you know, 83, 82, whatever it was. I even had one of the, you guys had to deal with, what, 6, 7 distributors, like all of us at the time.
Yeah.
And we were using all of them, too. But we had one guy call after we had a 10,000 run on the first issue. We had to do a reprint because it sold out. And I had a distributor call me when we announced we would do a reprint. And he said, would you print it exactly like the first printing? And I'll buy 25,000 copies. But don't mark it as a second print.
Oh.
We all know that distributors are a
cowardly and superstitious.
Well, that's true. Sadly, we, or maybe greatly, we don't have any but one to deal with.
Yeah. Well,
but they are a cowardly lot as well.
Yes.
But anyway, we went through that same thing. I refused the guy, of course, and I made a point of changing the cover color. I put second printing in big letters on the inside indicia. Second printing. Mm-hmm. It was on nicer paper, too.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, well.
So he said, I thought. I said, no.
That was the honorable thing.
Yeah. I would have done it.
I had a retailer call me with the same thing. We had 50,000 print run, and it sold out. And within 3 weeks of the first issue coming out, we had reorders for 140,000. So I'm like, we'll do a second printing and call it a second printing. So what I did is that the first book was $2.50. I actually did do a second print. I didn't call it. I called it a fan appreciation edition.
Nice.
I slapped a new cover on it, nice. And I put a poster in it. And we sold it for $1.95, and we sold 120,000 copies of it.
Yikes.
And no one's complained.
Nice work.
Nobody's complained. Yeah. So, yeah. That's a great way to get around a second printing. Call it a fan appreciation.
I just wanted to add a coda to Richard's story because it's an example of the outside world affecting what you do. Because Richard's decision to put everything that we had published up online for free happened in 2008 when Warner Brothers had just optioned ElfQuest for a film. And they told us, they let us know in no uncertain terms, that they would not appreciate us publishing anything for the duration of the option. Nothing new was supposed to come from us. And he, being very intelligent, knew that if we were out of sight for 2 to 4 years, however long the option lasted, then, you know, people were going to forget about ElfQuest. So that was one of the main motivations. Something from the outside affected us, but Richard got around it.
Well, it was a reprint, so you weren't publishing anything new, right? I mean, that was part of the logic was, this is a reprint, not something new.
Oh, it was, well, first of all, yes, you're absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. This is already out there, it's not new. Mm-hmm. But I'm Italian. And Warner Brothers said, don't do anything that would disturb our model. And on the outside, I'm, of course, Mr. Warner, of course, Mr. Brothers.
On the inside?
Hey, watch out for that guy.
But still, it was, you're absolutely right. I had forgotten that part. In this business, especially these days, if you don't publish something. If let's say you have a run and you publish it for 2 years and you've done a bunch of issues in 2 years and then you take a year off, you have effectively disappeared. You've mm-hmm. gone off the radar. Mm-hmm. And they wanted us to go off the radar for 4 years. Mm-hmm. No.
No.
Just no.
So Corbin, you know, jumped in and had just a glint in his eye.
Wait a second. Corbin Ford?
Corbin Ford.
Corbin
really?
Ford.
It's Corbin Dallas Multipass?
Corbin? Corbin, my man? Corbin?
From Comic Playground?
From Comic Playground. The Comic Playground.
Oh my gosh. What did he ask?
He was there. He was at the podium and everything.
Oh yeah.
And he leaned into
my podium. that didn't really record.
Once
it.
He's there,
he's standing behind
it's his no longer podium. Your podium.
Yeah, you're right.
Breathing on
you're
your
right.
neck.
That's awesome.
Friendship. And he leaned into the microphone. A glint in his eye and said
something special
to the entire panel.
He asked it as a question, though.
As a question.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
What story or character that isn't your creation to the panelists would you like to write? Or if it went one direction, what direction would you like to take it to maybe have something end up differently than what it is already?
An older story.
An older story. And, you know, you saw the panelists kind of perk up a little bit and say,
yeah.
In my day.
Yeah, all of them had a lot to say about this.
Yeah, so.
Which was very interesting
to
me.
It really was.
Yeah. I would think people wouldn't have wanted that. That's not something they would get that excited about. And when they did, I was like, geez.
Well, something that Maurer says a lot is that pretty much every writer will probably have a Batman or Superman story tucked away for that moment that they have that opportunity. Some of these characters are so iconic that I'm sure that they already have something planned out for them.
Kind of like how people are still to this day wanting to get more info about the Nicolas Cage Superman.
Right. And that documentary is amazing.
Yep.
So when we got this answer, I know I gave a standing ovation to Billy. Mm-hmm. So here's how it started off.
I want to write The Rocketeer. Oh, I love The Rocketeer. I love Dave Stevens. I have so many great Rocketeer stories. But I'm actually bringing back Miss Fury as a character that I've loved for 20 years. Miss Fury is the very first comic book created by a woman, written and illustrated by a woman, June Tarp Mills, and it was written in 1941, 6 months before Wonder Woman came out. And if you come by my booth, I think I'm at 1800 aisle somewhere, Catwoman looks like her. She is Catwoman, what Miss Fury looks like. She has a black cat suit with the black mask and the ears, and it's an amazing character. June Mills wrote and illustrated it. It was in newspaper strips, and Timely published it too.
Was it Marvel?
From 1941 to 1952, she did it, and then she stopped. And there's a break during World War II when I think she just needed a break. And we're setting our new story, and it's going to be launched as an Indiegogo, I think, in September or October through Dynamite, because she's in the public domain.
Yep.
So anyone could do it. But we want to do it as a love letter and homage to June, because so many people don't know who she is. But she's getting a lifetime achievement.
She's still alive?
No, she passed away. She passed away alone in 1983. Oh. Mm-hmm. But she's getting an Eisner this year for a legend thing. And I met with Trina. I had breakfast with Trina Robbins last year at San Diego, and she loved it. And she's like, I like you, because I told her the whole story. And it's called the Joy Division, if anyone's ever heard of that band, the Joy Division.
Yeah.
Well, if you know what the Joy Division was, the Joy Divisions were what the Germans took the most beautiful Jewish women out of the ghettos and literally turned them into prostitutes for the SS. And this is the story of her going in there to capture the head of this, but she does come across women of the Joy Division, and she ends up turning them into what's called the Black Furies. Now, Miss Fury, I'll be real quick, start off as the Black Fury. The first couple of strips had her as the Black Fury. But she turns these women into the Black Furies, and they start hunting the Germans like a female Inglorious Bastards. Mm. So it's pretty cool. Yeah. It all takes 1940 so, yeah. So the Rocketeer and Miss Fury. One of them I'm realizing, hopefully I'll get to do the Rocketeer.
Nice one.
Thank you.
You're up.
Sorry.
It's interesting about Tarpin Mills, just one postscript. She signed it, Tarpe,
yep,
or Tarp,
Tarpe,
however we said.
Yeah, it's Tarpe, Mills, really, but I just said Tarpe.
Because at that period, if she had signed her name June, she wouldn't have gotten the work.
Right. Because Wonder Woman was created by a man.
It's like DC Fontana,
at least on the paper,
instead of Dorothy.
Right, exactly. I mean, that was a blot on history that our industry was that kind of exclusive for too many years. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Tarpe, there's a few others,
Tarpe.
And I can't remember
all
of them, but there are a good number of comic creators from the 1940s who, in some cases, even changed their first name to Bill or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that was true in a lot of places. You know, hidden figures.
Yeah, that's the way the world
works.
That's the way the world works,
like
yeah.
Screenwriters, authors.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. So Brian, who's your character?
My character?
Yeah.
Well, if it doesn't have to be a comic book character, Philip Marlowe.
Mm. Mm.
If it has to be a comic figure, then I think Daredevil.
Oh, Daredevil. I love Daredevil, too. Yeah.
I think I could murder that one. Good. Make that one noir as well.
How about Richard and Wendy?
Well, I already got two.
Ooh.
Yes. This was, I believe it was the late 80s. Marvel was coming out with a book called Unlikely Heroes. And they had three different characters who were all very secondary in the background characters coming forward as heroes of different stories. And so being a fan of the Inhumans, and my favorite Inhuman was Triton, I decided I wanted to do a story about Triton, because I always pictured him as kind of an environmental a symbol, a nature spirit kind of creature, and I wanted to play him that way in the story, and I did. There was an environmental message in the story. There were also some Middle Eastern terrorists, but that's beside the point. So I actually got to do my character that I wanted to do.
Sweet.
Comes up and there's an oil slick.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
Says, hey, yeah, I gotta live here.
Yeah. Actually, he almost dies in an oil slick and gets pulled aboard a yacht, and then panic ensues. So
I like when things ensue.
Oh, yes, chaos ensues. My warped little psyche was shaped in the early to mid 1960s. By Marvel Comics.
A good period. Now,
I know what Marvel has done and what they have become and all of this stuff, and I can appreciate a lot of that. But the Avengers that I remember were the Avengers. Basically, it was Captain America and Hawkeye and a couple of other characters. And Infinity War and Endgame aside, I think if I was given the chance to go back in the day and do some Captain America and Hawkeye team-up stories.
Oh, yeah.
The way they were when Stan was writing and Jack was drawing and Don Heck was drawing and all of that, I think I would have fun with that. Mm-hmm. So
They did have a great dynamic.
It was incredible. The two characters. It was a very different dynamic.
A respectful but wise-ass sidekick, almost, for Hawkeye.
You just described me.
I didn't say handsome, though. That would have been a giveaway.
No, that would have been a lie.
Oh. Well, I lie for a living.
It depended on who was drawing him. Hey. Jack drew him kind of chunky, but Don Heck, boy, he drew pretty boys.
And beautiful women.
Made me a fan.
He's, yeah, very sadly underrated and often maligned,
yes.
Don Heck.
It's amazing off of that was that this was Ken finally was able to ask a question, and Ken, as you may or may not know on our show on Comic Playground, is the one who probably talks the most because he knows the most, which is great. But it was interesting that he only got one question in, and this is what it was. He was asking our panelists, he asked what the time frame you allow.
But what he was talking about is these holding deals that these studios take in. Sometimes it could be 5, 6, 7, 10 years, but they gave us some good insight on today's new landscape of creating media and how long the creators actually are going to sign off on it now to make sure if it's going to happen, it's going to happen when they want it to.
About a year. Seriously.
Yeah,
they take shorter and shorter options now.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. When we... Warner Brothers was the longest that we had. It was an initial 2-year term and then a second 2-year term.
Right.
And they wasted 2.5 years of our lives. Because for the first year and a half, it looked like they were doing stuff. They had a script writer that we thought was pretty good. But then they're also doing Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings stuff. They were also in pre-production or consideration of The Hobbit. And they made a decision that, all right, we've got this property. I think they made the decision to sit on it and just keep it off the market for the second 2-year option period. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of that, they say, oh, thanks, but no thanks, because it's too much like The Hobbit.
Oh, gee, great.
Excuse the heck out of me. On the inside, heck was another word. But they had the option on it. They could control it. So whenever we talk with people, it's a year tops. A year tops, because you know you can go to the altar so many times and get jilted, and pretty soon you get cynical in this business. Nobody's cynical in this business.
That's the thing, though. It's a business.
Yeah,
we still want to cling to the idea that we're just sharing.
Yeah,
no. Our magical dreams or whatever. All.
Mm.
No. At least I have magical dreams. Mm. There are mushrooms involved. Anyway. We like to believe that the people who share it have the same enthusiasm. But even if you're just straight ahead publishing, it's already in somebody else's mind. They know how to fix it.
Oh,
yeah.
Or change it just to mess with you.
And if you don't meet their expectations, boy, you are the black hat of all
time. Oh, yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
Which is why I stopped doing it. We worked with other creators on other titles for a period of 4 or 5 years, and it was fun, it was educational, it was at times really infuriating, and I said, no, let's get back to what we do.
Yeah, I had an experience with them, and I said, I'm not renewing the option. And they went through this whole thing about, you know, and they had a company called Franchise Films, and they made Battlefield Earth, and Ken Carter, and and I said, and forgive me, and I said, well, I don't know if I want to do that. And they said, well, Billy, you don't know how to make movies. I said, well, quite frankly, I don't think you know how to make movies. And I said, you know, because all your movies suck. And I said, and worst thing, they all lose money.
I had it.
And they brought in someone to come in who write the screenplay, who wrote a terrific Wonder Woman spec script. This is about a decade ago. I could tell you guys who it is. I'm not going to name him, but he's an asshole.
PG.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. He's a butthole. I apologize.
Much better. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Are you?
He's a loser. So
wind up in the same place.
Yeah, and then after this big argument goes and the whole thing, and the one of the producers said, well, we didn't do that bad on Get Carter. Money wise, you know, so it was, that's the, you just get to that point because, you know, I don't need to do this, you know, it's glorious. Imagine if they do, then you're, you know, could be set for life technically, or that's the dreams and everyone wants to see that creation on the silver screen.
I know, but don't you find that there's a sort of a state of mind out there that the property in and of itself is not valid until it's ended up on the screen.
Yeah,
it's almost as if its worth isn't intrinsic as it was originally created. It has to go into the larger media to have significance.
We'll show you how to do it.
Yeah. And especially now. And you know, and the thing I like is I actually love television. Yes. I mean, I think if more people watch Game of Thrones this weekend than all the people that watch Titanic. Mm-hmm. You know, people, TV, television, and Netflix and things like that. It's so much big. Streaming is bigger than film audiences. So I'd love to do that, you know.
Well, that was it. We had a tremendous time doing this panel. I wish we could have given it to you guys as it happened. But like I said, there were some technical difficulties of no fault of our own. I'm going to constantly refer to that. But we had a blast. They had a blast. Some of them saying they wished it had gone a lot longer. Billy Tucci said that to quite a few people. Brian Augustin saying if it wasn't the one of the best panels he'd ever been on. I think he actually said it was the best he'd ever been on, which made us feel really good, especially me because I'd never done anything like this before.
And the first time you just killed it.
I knocked it out. No, it was definitely, if anybody's wondering, and you can't tell from this, which is what kind of stinks, but it was 100% a team effort to make it happen, not just the Comic Playground and Fireside Chats podcast, but just the individuals involved that that just loved each other. And
we get a group hug now?
No, I think we've had a few of them today.
I just felt you were going into Shatner, like the pacing of
this was something special, something I love almost as much as I love myself. No, but I hope you guys enjoyed it, and as we continue in the future, we know we're gonna do we're gonna fight to get into the room and make sure we take care of everything. I don't even know if we could
anything it takes we done. Or whatever it takes.
Any, that's what it should have been. Anything it takes. No, in all honesty, this is the best we could do for this situation, but I hope you enjoy it because we really did, and the answers that they gave us, and to watch this panel, these panelists, this crew of people come together. Many people were saying, hey, it was like you guys had all known each other for years, and a lot of people had just met that day, so it's pretty cool.
Just want to thank Donnie.
No, thank you.
Welcome to Fireside.com.
Yeah, that's the one.
Come on, help me out. At Comic Playground everywhere. And where are you at?
The one that you just said. You go to At Welcome to Fireside on
Instagram.
Yeah,
I'm doing
Instagram.
The social media.
Or
Fireside Crew on Twitter.
What?
At the OG podcast.
You know what? Beep you.
Check us out for real. At Comic Bike Playground.
Bruh, bruh.
No, it's over. We don't deserve it.
We don't deserve it.